You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, January 12th, 2023, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone.
How are we all doing today?
We're here.
Doing well.
Not bad for January 12th, not bad.
So we do have to begin the show with some sad news. We all learned just today, really just a couple hours ago, that our friend in skepticism, Harriet Hall, died yesterday on January 11th. She was 78 years old. For those of you who don't know, Harriet was one of the regular authors and editors on Science-Based Medicine. Actually, Bob, you and I met her at the same time.
Yeah.
If you remember, we met her at that health conference in California, like in 2000, like the early 2000s, before we were even doing...
Wow.
Way back before we were doing the show.
I thought it was the late 90s, but yeah, it could have been the early aughts.
And we immediately connected. It's like, oh, we're both physicians who are, you know, skeptical of alternative medicine. You know, we connected with Wally Sampson at that time. And, you know, she was one of the writers, contributors to Scientific Review of Alternative Medicine.
Yeah.
And then she was one of the original people I invited to blog with me at Science-Based Medicine, you know, along with David Gorski and others. So she's, you know, had quite a career. You know, I respect anyone who spends a huge chunk of their life fighting for science, skepticism, and reason, which she did. I mean, she was a retired physician who spent her retirement, you know, working to promote science and skepticism. Yeah. She also authored a book. Her, 2008, she published Women Aren't Supposed to Fly, a memoir, the memoirs of a female flight surgeon. She was like, you know, a flight surgeon. And at the time, that was very unusual for a woman to take that career path. So she was a bit of a trailblazer in that way as well. You know, she was contributing every week, you know, to Science-Based Medicine. So she is going to be sorely missed.
Yeah, I remember the first time I met Harriet at TAM. She was one of many people that came up to the table and introduced themselves. You know, this was back when we had like a table. Remember, guys? Mm-hmm. We had a table at TAM.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
And we were just, we're a podcast, and we would just sit there.
That's right.
You know what I mean? We'd sit at this table. Anyway, so I definitely remember, we're going way back in TAM, probably TAM 2005.
No, mm-hmm. we didn't go 2005.
No, I'm sorry.
2007
was our first year, yeah.
Yeah, you're right. She was always kind, always like, you know, wanted to get into a conversation. And I really respect the work that she did on SBM. You know, because I would read most of the blogs. I still read most of the blog posts that come out on SBM. And, you know, you have a body of work like that. That is, that's a great legacy.
Yeah, it's a huge body of work. She, I'm pretty sure she is the one who coined the term on SBM, tooth fairy science, which I use all the time. The idea is that, you know, let's say you wanted to scientifically examine the phenomenon of the tooth fairy and you know, catalog like how much money children are given based upon this, which tooth they leave under the pillow and blah, blah, blah. You do all kinds of, you do all of that research just looking at the details, but none of that would prove that the tooth fairy is real, right? And a lot of alternative medicine does that kind of tooth fairy science where they're talking sort of about the phenomenon, but they're never in doing the kind of investigation that would show whether or not it's real. And that was a really useful idea that she crystallized extremely well. And I frequently go back to that. All right, guys. Well, let's go right into some news items. And Jay, you're going to start us off by talking about the mystery of Roman concrete.
It's amazing. This concrete gets up and walks around. It's totally Roman.
Is your concrete running?
If you read history about Romans, you will definitely learn that they're known for their military,
their roads,
politics, their social institutions, but they're also known for incredible feats of engineering. And this has been something that I have been interested in. I love Italy and I love ancient Rome. And I always thought that the engineering that they did was damn near miraculous, what they were able to pull off back then. So one of the first things that comes to mind for me is the Roman aqueducts and the fact that some of them are still being used today to bring water to Rome. I mean, we're talking about 2,000 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, and there's many ancient Roman buildings that are still standing. You know, there's quite a number of still standing buildings, and some of them in fantastic condition.
There's a couple things that need to be thought about when, at least when discussing something like this in terms of like buildings that are centuries and millennia old. First off, there's survivorship bias. We don't see all the buildings that collapsed. So you're seeing by definition, you're seeing the ones that are the oldest and have lived the longest. Mm-hmm. So that's something that needs to be considered. And also, there's a maintenance issue. If you maintain a building for centuries, it's going to last for centuries. And so if you don't maintain it, and it's not going to last as long. So some of the famous Roman buildings that are still around, are still extant, have been maintained religiously, if you will, for centuries. And that plays a part as well.
Bob, I have a feeling it's something more.
Yeah, I'm just saying that that you should be thinking of when you're thinking about, oh, these buildings have survived.
Those
forever.
Are good points, but yeah. There are buildings like the Pantheon, you know, which wasn't maintained religiously for the entirety.
Oh, yes, I think it was.
No, I mean, Rome was sacked by barbarians and ransacked for its raw material, and it wasn't not – I mean, for a lot of that time, sure, but you can't say continuously –
No, not continuously, but yeah, you could take a century off of maintenance, you know, I guess, and also don't forget massive over-engineering because they were very conservative for some of those structures, so they were massively over-engineered, something that you could never, ever do today because it would just be way too expensive and you can't do it. But I just want to throw those caveats out there, that's all.
All right.
Yeah, so when we look at modern science and modern engineering, and we look at concrete that's made today, scientists have realized that it is not the same thing from a chemical perspective and from a component perspective of the concrete that was made 2,000 years ago.
Yeah, Jay, and if you look at concrete today, none of it has survived for 2,000 years.
No way. It can't survive that long.
That was a
so,
joke.
So, you know, you got to ask the question, what did these ancient wise people know that we don't know, right? It's almost like they got visited by UFOs and, you know, but it isn't that. There's science here. A common denominator in a lot of the buildings that are still up in ancient Rome is that concrete was used. And don't think that modern engineers haven't noticed this and haven't been studying it, because they have. Lots of people for decades have been studying Roman concrete, trying to figure out, like, you know, what's the deal about it? Like, why does it have the fortitude that it has? And the study was done. MIT, Harvard University, and scientists from Italy and Switzerland have recently made some discoveries that I think legitimately reveal the answer now. So we can finally, you know, say that we do understand it. And their research is now published in the journal Science Advances. So previously, researchers thought the key ingredient to Roman concrete was what, guys? Do you know what the...
Volcanic ash.
Yeah, the volcanic ash.
Right. You nailed it. Pozzolanic material. This is volcanic ash from the area around a city in Italy called Pozzuoli. Romans would ship this ash all over the Roman Empire to construction sites and use this in their concrete. And researchers... you know, we're pretty convinced, most of them were convinced that this was the secret ingredient that was doing something to the concrete. This team of researchers recently, when they were looking, you know, microscopically at the concrete, they found these very small white minerals in these samples from Roman concrete. And these minerals are called lime clasts. That's with the C-L-A-S-T-S, right? Because Romans also used lime in their concrete. Modern concrete does not have lime clasts. And what's funny is when these minerals were first discovered in the concrete, they were thought to be due to inferior mixing techniques or even low-quality materials. Now, the researchers from this study found that the lime clasts are actually the reason why Roman concrete has lasted as long as it has, because they give concrete the ability to self-repair. And when I first read about this, you know, a while ago, right, this isn't a new thing to hear in the news. I remember reading something along these lines, that there was evidence that the concrete was able to do some type of self-repair. I really didn't believe it, because it just sounds like impossible. How can concrete doesn't move? You know, it doesn't have any ability to do that. Just intuitively, it didn't seem correct. Well, there is a reason here. The researchers used high-resolution multi-scale imaging and chemical mapping techniques that gave them more information about these lime clasts. When Romans mixed their concrete, it was thought that they used slaked lime. Quick lime and slaked lime are two forms of lime, which is a common term for a type of material that's made from calcium oxide, right, and calcium hydroxide. So quick lime, also known as burnt lime, is made by heating limestone, which is calcium carbonate, to a very high temperature, and this causes it to release carbon dioxide, and it leaves behind calcium oxide. And at that point, it's in the form of powder or lumps, and it's highly reactive. Slaked lime, also known as hydrated lime, is made by adding water to quick lime, causing it to undergo, you know, this chemical reaction that releases some heat, not as much heat as quick lime. The result is a fine powder or a paste, and it's less reactive than quick lime, and it's also known as lime putty, right? So we have these two different ways that lime can be affected chemically by what you mix it with and with heat. Now, in summary, quick lime is calcium oxide and is made by heating limestone, while slaked lime is calcium hydroxide and is made by adding water to quick lime. All right. Okay. So that was the part that took me a little while to wrap my head around, because when you read engineering blogs and posts, they use the lingo like you wouldn't believe.
Sure.
You have to every sentence, you got to look up three words. You're like, what?
It is true.
Right?
You need the engineering dictionary handy.
Totally. It's fascinating, but it took me a while to get there. And I will admit, what did I do, guys?
You use ChatGPT.
ChatGPT.
Yep. Yeah, baby.
Ask Jeeves.
I asked ChatGPT to explain the difference between quick lime and slaked lime, and it did it in an unbelievably coherent way. So thank
you. Did you double check it?
I did. It also said that Bob sucks, and I just ignored that.
Did you double check that?
First-hand knowledge, baby. So using spectroscopy, researchers were able to determine that the lime clasts were formed under extreme temperature, the same temperatures that using quick lime would produce. Right? What's going on here? So they concluded that there were two main reasons to use the hot mixing quick lime process. First, the intense heat allows high temperature associated compounds to form, which are the things I'm telling you about. In this case, the lime clasts, right? So under the extreme temperature that the quick lime process creates, you know, chemistry happens at that temperature that wouldn't ordinarily happen at lower temperatures. And these lime clasts are created in that heat. Now, the second reason was that the extreme heat reduces the curing and setting times, and this allowed for faster construction, which I find interesting as well. Like, if you've ever read about the Hoover Dam and how unbelievably complicated that build was, and the pouring of the concrete and the heat and the cooling that they had to use to cool the concrete so it's set for the next day, right? There's all sorts of things going on. And, you know, modern concrete was behaving differently than this concrete because they needed to cool modern concrete. The heat didn't help it cure faster. Oh, it's just fascinating. You know, there's like tons of chemistry going on inside all this rock. So in hot mixing, the lime clasts form a brittle nanoparticle architecture. And when these minerals are fractured during stress, they become a source of calcium. And when mixed with water, they recrystallize into calcium carbonate and they fill any nearby cracks.
That's cool. Wow.
So they can also mix with volcanic ash, and the volcanic ash that's in the mix would also add to the strength of the existing concrete when this process happened, when a crack happened and the nanoparticle broke all of a sudden calcium was available and the ash mixes in with that. And it's unbelievable that they figured this out. Now, in fact, these little self-repairing reactions help stop cracks from spreading throughout the entire block of concrete because it stops them dead in their tracks and they don't propagate. Exactly. The researchers also examined Roman concrete that shows evidence of these cracks being fixed. So check this out. The researchers proved that all of this was taking place because they created a sample of both Roman concrete and modern concrete. They stress fractured the samples and then they ran water through the cracks. And guess what happened? In 2 weeks, the cracks in the Roman concrete were completely repaired.
Yep.
They simulated it. And the modern concrete had cracks that water was freely flowing through and nothing happened to that concrete.
Right, because there's nothing in there.
Right.
Right.
So, you know, if you extrapolate this out into reality and you're thinking about, you know, the aqueducts and everything, you know, the aqueducts are like this remarkably heavily trafficked concrete. You know, like it's being used and abused by water every day, all day, 24 hours a day for 2,000 years. And it's still there. And they're saying that it's there because of this process and because of, you know, because of the quicklime, the use of quicklime, the heat, and then those nanoparticles that are there to literally seal the cracks as they occur.
So is this something we can economically start incorporating into modern concrete technologies?
That's what I read, Ev. I read that they are basically formulating this. You know, they're coming up with what the formulations need to be in order to mass produce it. They're also hoping that, you know, concrete that could last a lot longer would eventually lead to less concrete being needed, yeah, you know, to be made.
Yeah, we're constantly repairing and replacing concrete that doesn't have this kind of ability to sustain itself for that long a period of time.
And isn't concrete, am I wrong, Jay, isn't concrete made from sand and we're having like actually like mining, we're over mining the world's sand?
Ooh. I read that, Kara, as well. Not in this go around, but I have read that in the past.
Yeah, I have a friend who wrote a whole book about it, that there are literally like conflict zones around sand. Like actually sand is a pretty precious commodity that we don't talk about very often.
No. Well, all the more reason to where when we make concrete, you know, like let's have it last a long time. You know, mm-hmm. like Evan said, you know, I've been living in Connecticut my entire life, and there's a town called Waterbury that has quite a bit of highway bridges. And I've seen them fully repair that highway 3 times now in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of concrete just in that one highway stretch that goes over the town, you know? So like that multiplied times the entire world, right? Like think about all this concrete that's being repaired globally.
Yeah. Yeah. As long as it doesn't, you know, make the environmental issues any worse by whatever this process or incorporation of the new material you have to put into it, and it remains economical to get longer-lasting concrete, I don't see – there's no downside.
Yeah. I can't imagine that it would have to be more environmentally taxing considering that they did it 2,000 years ago before the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, but the gases are released in the hot mixing process. So is that a new contribution to the already environmental issues we're having with concrete?
Yeah, they got to figure all that out. I mean, this is them studying it, and they're going to – all the off-gassing and anything that happens with that concrete, they're going to figure it all out. But in the just in the 30,000 foot view, though, if you think about it, you know, this seems like a no-brainer here. You know, we want concrete that's way more durable and that can last a very long time. You know, why wouldn't we just immediately start using that process then, even in the short term, if there is off-gassing that would lead to greenhouse gases or whatever? It's still probably going to be on par with how horrible concrete production is.
Yeah, but I mean, even still, we got to run the numbers and we got to see how it scales and how cost effective it is, et cetera. So, but I mean, it seems like there's a lot of potential there, and then maybe they do need to iterate it a bit to make that all the numbers work out. But, you know, one other angle to this, because we often say, oh, isn't it amazing that the ancient Romans were able to create concrete better than what we have today? But we have to remember. You know, that first of all, there's a couple of things there. You know, ancient people were smart. You know, they were as smart as we were. It's not like they were, you know, mentally primitive. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But also, we underestimate how much time they had, right? Because our Industrial Revolution is so compressed. They had centuries, sometimes millennia, of trial and error for core technologies. Yeah, so they worked that shit out.
Also, they probably – I mean, the thing that I was thinking about the whole time you were saying this was like how funny that they probably didn't really know. Like they knew that this was strong.
Oh, they trial knew and that error.
Well, but they knew immediately.
Sure.
They didn't know it was going to last 2,000 years.
No, but what they knew was that it cured faster and therefore it was more efficient in the building process. And I think the long –
Right, like when they were making – and then it held its shape.
Yeah,
and
so it had some immediate
job.
Benefits. I think the long-term benefits are just a happy accident.
Yeah, and they had no idea what was happening at the molecular level.
No,
like
you're
how cool that they just happened upon this process. I mean, obviously it was they didn't discover it, they invented it because like you said, they were actually engineers, you know. But But that, yeah, there was this kind of lasting effect that they, there's no way they could have known about that.
The nanostructured whatever stuff.
Right.
I mean, it is possible that early, this is just conjecture here, but it is possible that they tried, like Steve was saying, like trial and error, they tried all different kinds of concrete. And, oh, look, this concrete is breaking apart after 5 years, you know, mm-hmm. and then they try something else. They finally stumble upon this and it stayed. It had the fortitude, you know, and then,
yeah.
But I agree, Kara. They didn't know that there was nanoparticles in there that were self-healing. Like they couldn't detect it if we couldn't detect it.
Nor did they think to reinforce it with steel rods.
Yeah, it's true.
Right. They didn't go to that level.
Nope.
But did they even
didn't
have
need to with this stuff?
They didn't even have. Did they have steel?
Well, at some point, they.
I think they, if anything, there was bronze.
Iron. You know, we 2,000 years ago, absolutely.
They may have had it, but from what I read, they didn't incorporate it in the application of concrete.
Very interesting.
Let's move on, Kara. Tell us about the status of neuroimaging mental health disorders.
Yeah, this is something that I guess it's funny because working in this field, I never really thought much about neuroimaging as a diagnostic tool. I mean, I often think about it in a research kind of mm-hmm. setting, like an fMRI study or like a PET scan or a CAT scan or anything in order to try and understand a little bit more about underlying neuronal or neuropsychiatric issues. But the idea that you could scan somebody's brain and that would be predictive or diagnostic of a mental health problem is interestingly like something I often don't think about. And maybe that's just because my bias comes from psychology where we just don't use those kinds of tools except in a research.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you as a counterbalance, I think about mm-hmm. it all the time because
I'm sure you do because neurologists have brain scans, right?
That's been the burning question is when is neuroimaging going to cross that line from being a research tool to having the sensitivity and specificity to be useful as a clinical diagnostic tool? That's what we're talking about. Obviously.
Yeah, and not just in neurology, but in neuropsychiatry.
In psychiatry. That's what I mean.
Yeah. A new study is published actually yesterday as of this recording in the American Journal of Psychiatry, and it is a follow-up study, or it's not really a follow-up study because it's a different research group, but it's like a replication study, basically, of a study that was published in 2021. So in 2021, a massive research group from, I think it's like Emory, but also Harvard, and also it looks like maybe, are these some VAs? I'm not sure. But a big mix of different institutions, individuals from a lot of different institutions, published an article in 2021 called Brain-Based Biotypes of Psychiatric Vulnerability in the Acute Aftermath of Trauma. And so in that study, basically what they did is they had a first cohort and then an internal replication cohort, so two different groups of people. And these were all like people that they found organically in emergency departments all over the country. And so basically people showed up in the ED after a severe trauma. Specifically, they were looking at motor vehicle collisions and they scanned their brains as actually just part of their treatment. But they were able to then scan their brains 2 weeks after. And based on certain patterns of brain activity, and this is fMRI activity, so actually that wasn't part of treatment. Let me clarify there. They actually looked at fMRI scans 2 weeks after the motor vehicle crash that they were involved in, and they developed different profiles of activity. And they looked specifically at three different kind of things. They looked at response to threat, response to reward, and ability or response to inhibitory signals. So basically, seeing fearful faces in the scanner versus playing a game in which they would get a monetary reward, like a small gambling game, and then a no-go paradigm, which is very, very common, like a very common inhibitory paradigm. You know, it's like hit the X's, but not the O's. Yeah. And so you have to learn to inhibit. And in doing this investigation, they found, this massive research group actually found that they could predict with some fidelity how severe the PTSD after these, the experience of these car crashes was based on the way that their brains reacted to these tasks in the scanner. Now, the new study said, oh, that's cool. Let's see if we can do that again. And so this was a group from Yale, so your colleague, Steve, and they looked at something very, very similar. They looked at neuroimaging data that was collected from survivors of recent trauma, but this time in Israel, and they could not replicate the findings. So that's the news item here. Although they could actually find the different clusters of activity and they could say, okay, here is, for example, activity that is synchronized between, like, this is what's going on in the amygdala and this is what's going on in the prefrontal cortex and here's what's going on in the hippocampus. And they were able to look at these different brain regions and say, this pattern of activity tells us that this person is having a heightened threat response and that they're having a heightened, you know, response to reward, or they're having a hard time with inhibition, whatever the case may be. They found similar patterns and they could actually specify them, but they did not find a significant relationship or an ability, I should say, to predict severe PTSD symptoms later on. And so the conclusions of this were, A, the jury's still out. B, maybe we can't actually... Caution is warranted when attempting to define subtypes of psychiatric vulnerability using neural indices before treatment implications can be fully realized. And also, these original brain, they're calling them biotypes of trauma, these brain-based biotypes of trauma resilience and psychopathology may not generalize to other populations. So here they were looking at, you know, trauma survivors in Israel versus a group in America. Maybe there's a cultural difference there. And I think that opens up to me the conversation that I would like to have with all of you, which is this even this holy grail that we're talking about, being able to use a scan, being able to look at neuronal activity or patterns of neuronal activity and say that is schizophrenia on the brain or that is depression on the brain. Is that reasonable, meaningful? Is there a threshold cutoff? Are neurological, or I should say neuropsychiatric conditions, aka psychological conditions, wholly organic in nature? Are we ever going to be able to use a scan as a diagnostic tool with a lot of fidelity?
Like an acid test.
So I've thought about this a lot. I've written about this, you know, a lot of times in the context of what I call psychiatry denial or mental illness denial, because the mental illness deniers will say that mental illness isn't even real because you can't image it, right? That's one of their...
Or you can't, like,
yeah, there's no
test
objective diagnosis. It's
yeah.
a clinical diagnosis, and they dismiss that all yeah. of that, which is problematic, of course. There's two ways to approach it. You know, one way is to say, well, it's primarily a limitation of the technology, and, you know, with a lot of mental illness, there's no pathology. Like, the brain cells themselves, as far as we know, like in most of these things, we're talking about depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, they're normal. They're healthy cells. The pathology is in the pattern of interconnections among the neurons.
And or the actual neurochemicals that are involved, or so how they fire.
It's at a wiring yeah. and a neurochemical level. Mm-hmm. And we're not imaging at that level. We're looking for brain tumors and inflammation and things that, like, you know, biological pathology. So we wouldn't expect.
Yeah, an fMRI, you're just looking at yeah. metabolism. Like, that's all you're seeing is how active is the brain.
Right.
In
so
those
then,
regions.
So we definitely need to get from anatomical scans to functional scans. Mm-hmm. With that, you might think we have a chance of diagnosing it. So now that gets to the second issue of, is there something inherent in our inherently limited in our understanding of these entities that means that they don't have a reliable enough neuroanatomical correlate that we can turn right. that, like, a functional scan into a diagnostic criteria,
right, a quote-unquote biomarker.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. like, if maybe schizophrenia is our idea of what that is too vague. It's multiple things that, you know, overlapping. And so we're never going to come up with a diagnosis for schizophrenia until we come up with a better definition of schizophrenia itself. Maybe it's really multiple things.
Right.
And same. So I think that both of those things are simultaneously true. The technology needs to evolve, although we're getting there. We're actually getting close with some of the functional scans. Again, they're at the research useful level. But I think to be clinically useful, I think our clinical labels may need to improve. But that's something we're going to have to look back on, you know, once we've done it, you know.
I also think that we can't look at all psychiatric or psychological diagnoses. We can't paint them all with the same brush because like even when we casually throw like depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, whatever, like schizophrenia, I think is going to be a much better candidate for diagnosis at this level than, for example, anxiety.
Yeah, I agree. Although schizophrenia itself is already like clinically researched that, there's really like eight things that make up schizophrenia.
For sure. It's like autism, right? Yeah. We know that's why we call them spectrum disorders.
Yeah, exactly.
Like there's so many different, and that's the thing that I think is important. And we've made this distinction before on the show between sort of like diseases and like syndromes
or disorders,
or like I mean there's disorders, like there's a lot of different ways that you can talk about these things, but when it comes to mental illness we are looking at a constellation of symptoms and the thing that pushes any mental illness over the edge to being diagnosable from a psychological perspective, but I'm assuming also from a psychiatric perspective, because we use the same DSM, right? The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, is that one of the specifiers always has to be that the experience, the symptomatology is so severe that it interferes with daily life.
Kind of be debilitating,
And so what's the difference between a depressed brain and a clinically depressed brain? What's the difference between healthy anxiety and an anxiety disorder?
It's a continuum.
And that's where things start to get really, really messy. I personally believe in a continuum, what we call a dimensional diagnostic approach, as opposed to a categorically diagnostic approach. Yeah. I don't think somebody is this or that. I think they're somewhere on a continuum.
Yeah, I agree.
And when you can say that's over the threshold, now it becomes relevant or necessary for whether it be medication or psychotherapy or a combination or behavioral interventions.
Yeah. And it's context dependent because it's interacting with other variables and the environment and the patient's situation.
And we use the term biopsychosocial a lot in psychology. We also talk about a diathesis stress model because you'll see this as well. I want to give a very brief but fascinating example, and I'm curious of you guys' thoughts. I did a – do you guys know what Story Collider is?
Yeah, sure, I did
a Story Collider. Oh, yeah, of course you do because Brian Wecht.
I was one of the people that started
I did a Story Collider several years ago, and one of the individuals that shared the stage with me – so I think three of us went that night – was this – fascinating. I think he was a neurologist, maybe a psychologist or a psychiatrist. I'm not sure. But he was really interested in psychopathy, like antisocial personality disorder and psychopathy. And he was doing this fascinating study and he was looking at the brains of psychopaths. And then he had normal controls and they didn't have enough controls for their study. So they're recruiting like their friends and family. And they were one down. So he somewhat semi unethically had his own brain scan to throw it into the mix. And
you told us this story.
I told you this story. And they unblinded it and they were like, oh my God, the researcher's brain looked like the brain of a psychopath.
Yeah, he himself but is a psychopath.
Gotta go.
Yeah, but he had never done anything antisocial in his life. And their views were that psychopathy is not just about having the right brain structure, brain chemistry, whatever. There also have to be life experiences.
Right.
That helps sort of push you. Yes, the diathesis and the stress, right? Yeah. So how were they raised? What sort of exposures do they have? Early childhood, insults, things like that. And I think with psychiatric disorders, it's so important to remember that some people might be sensitive to or a predisposition to psychosis, but never actually experience psychosis or only have one episode once and then it resolves and they never experience it again. Whereas other people, because of certain life stressors, might actually experience a lot of psychosis throughout their lives.
Yeah. Some things may only be a problem when they occur with other things, whether that's other personality traits or environmental triggers or whatever.
Right. So this stuff is a construct.
Yeah.
I mean, it is. Yeah, yeah. Yes, it's also real. I'm not saying it's not real, but it is still a construct. And I think if we try to view it the same way that we try to view, I don't know, a dysfunctional cell type in the body, a cell that can't process a certain protein, it's not the same thing as a lot of ways that we look at medical problems.
Right.
Yeah.
I agree. All right, that was cool. Let's go on. Actually, again, I had sort of two news items that I was debating about, so I'm just going to give a very quick honorable mention to the one that I'm not going to talk about tonight, mainly because, Evan, you and Jay both talked about using artificial intelligence in drug development, and lo and behold, there was a study published that showed that using AI in a particular kind of drug development, designing polymeric long-acting injectables, works. That when you that the AI algorithms were able to effectively predict which formulations were more likely to function. Now, very quickly, long-acting injectables, or LAIs, basically are a technology for injecting a drug into your muscle and then have it be slowly released over time. Like Depo-Provera is probably the one most people have heard about. This is also called the Depo technology. Interestingly, when I was researching it, I wrote about it recently, a lot of the long-acting injectables, Kara, that are already on the market are antipsychotics. Because
that makes sense.
Makes total sense, really? Because you're going to give somebody who has schizophrenia, one of the biggest problems of treating schizophrenia is
their medicine staying on their meds.
If they're psychotic, they think that the whole thing is a conspiracy, whatever. So the disease
and there's so many rates of homelessness
treatment.
And
But imagine if you can give somebody who is suffering from schizophrenia one injection and they're good for 2 months, 3 months.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
That would make a huge difference.
So anyway, that the LAIs are hugely important. I think we're going to be seeing much more of them. There may come a time when the idea of taking a pill 3 times a day for every day, it seems archaic. Why would you do that? You just give yourself a shot. You're good for 3 months or whatever the duration is. Could be anywhere. Yeah. The ones that are on the market now are anywhere from like 2 weeks to 3 months.
What about overdose? What about overdose concerns with that from accidents?
Well, only if the technology breaks down or you break it down. So that's always like this came up with the long-acting opioids. People found a way to crush it to sabotage the slow release
over time.
But then you have to include mechanisms that prevent that from happening. Like if you do that, it also releases an inactivating agent. So
nice,
interesting.
So the AI has the potential to like dramatically speed up this research because, you know, when you think about it, there's so many potential formulations and you have to test each one in animals and then get them to human research. Imagine if you can cut out like 90% of the research and get right to the ones that are most likely to work. It's massive increase in efficiency.
That'd be nice. All
right, but I'm going to be talking about using tumor cells to kill tumors. And this is pretty exciting. This is actually not a totally new technology. We've been doing this for several years. And essentially what you do is you take part of the tumor, like a cancer from a patient, let's say glioblastoma, which is a horrible brain cancer, and you genetically alter it so that it targets the immune system at the cancer, right? So it's expressing proteins on its surface it's basically making it more attractive to the immune system, more interactive with the immune system, which then, it's like a vaccine. It's literally a tumor vaccine, which you make from the tumor itself. Does that make sense? But you got to tweak it first so that it activates the immune system more. So that's already been happening, basically tumor vaccines. The new bit, the new research is using live tumor cells. Now, the previously, this is the first time that's happened. Previously, they would use inactivated tumor cells because, you know, you don't want to inject live tumor cells into people, because that could seed more tumors. That's not a good thing. But there's an advantage to using live tumor cells, and that is that they will inherently seek out other tumor cells of the same type.
Search
and destroy, exactly. So what the researchers did is they used, the name of their study was Bifunctional Cancer Cell-Based Vaccine Concomitantly Drives Direct Tumor Killing and Anti-Tumor Immunity. So it's bifunctional in that it will directly kill tumor cells and then also be a vaccine against further tumor cells because it's live. So it seeks out the main tumor, and then they could basically include different payloads in there that would stimulate those tumor cells to undergo spontaneous apoptosis, right, which is programmed cell death. The cells just kill themselves, basically. They showed that this is a study in mice, and that had glioblastoma, and this treatment eliminated the tumor, which is, for glioblastoma, that's amazing. Now, of course, eliminating the tumor is not the same thing as a cure, because there could be lots of surviving cancer cells that are just not part of the main tumor, right? So you have to kill them too. And so that's where the activating the host's immune system comes in. So you kill the tumor and immunize the patient against return of the cancer by, again, activating the immune system like a vaccine. That's why it's the bifunctional. Very cool. We only have mouse data so far, but very encouraging. You know, of course, a lot of things that are encouraging at the mouse level don't make their way to human treatments, but, you know, we're crossing our fingers with this. This could be a whole new technology, you know, a new whole new way of fighting cancer that is sort of the next step, and continue this incremental, you know, advance that we're doing in terms of increasing cancer survival. And if it works on cancers like glioblastoma, which again is one of the hardest to treat, one of the most horrible brain tumors there is, that would be great. Now, what do you think they used to modify these tumor cells into the engineered therapeutic tumor cells, as they're calling them? CRISPR-Cas9. This is just another example of the effect that CRISPR is having on biological research. Now, maybe at this point you're thinking, but Steve, what about the fact that they're injecting live tumor cells into the patient? Aren't they concerned that that may seed other tumors, even if it's, you know, killing the existing tumor? And yes, they were concerned about that. So guess what they did? They
killed the cancer
they
cells.
They also included two kill switches in these therapeutic tumor cells.
Self-destruct buttons,
absolutely. So one is a rapamycin-activated capsaicin 9. So what rapamycin is an antibiotic. Capsaicin 9 is an enzyme that will kill the cell. So basically, they genetically modified these therapeutic tumor cells so that when you give the patient a course of antibiotics, of rapamycin, it destroys the injected therapeutic tumor cells. It activates the kill switch and kills them. So
why can't we just figure out a way to get that into the cancer cells? Like, that would be amazing.
I mean, any time that you can get CRISPR to target tumor cells and not healthy cells, there's all kinds of things you could do to the cancer cells, right? This would be one of them, but there's all kinds of other things. You could just chop up the DNA, right? We talked about that before. You get CRISPR to target cancer genes that are different from healthy genes, and then it just cuts up the DNA so that the cells die, you know? So that all kinds of CRISPR-mediated approaches are being researched now to treat cancer. And I do think that's going to be one of the low-hanging fruit, you know, for CRISPR therapeutics, either directly or indirectly, like with this approach, you know, you modifying tumor cells into therapeutic tumor cells. So it's really has three functions. You know, it has direct tumor killing activity, anti-tumor vaccine activity, and self-destruct activity. You know, all three of those things were included. And again, at the mouse research level, the effect was pretty dramatic. So, you know, we 10 years from now, we could be looking at this as like a game changer in terms of cancer treatment.
Similar moment.
But, you know, what always happens is, you know, my whole career I've been reading about these new cancer treatments, like new approaches to treating cancer. They always sound fantastic. Like, this is going to be a game changer. Like, I remember first hearing about, we're going to keep new blood vessels from growing into tumors. Mm-hmm. We're going to, you know, right, so we'll starve the tumors of blood supply and they'll die. Like, that's great. We've cured cancer. You know, you keep, it always feels like it's going to be really dramatic. And what happens is the treatment works and it's effective, but it's incremental. It just is like one more step forward, you know, in terms of it's one more treatment, one more incremental advance. It all adds together, but it wasn't like the cure for cancer. So I
and also,
that's how we felt about CRISPR.
Oh, yeah. Wait.
Right about Christmas. Well, and also, cancer is, like, awesome at what it does. Yes. Like, too awesome at what it does. So even with, like, really good chemotherapies, which don't have the specificity that you were talking about, they kill all cells. Not all cells, but different generations of chemotherapies do different things.
Too many
but, yeah, rapidly cells, dividing cells. Yeah. It depends on what they target.
They evolve. Cancer cells evolve.
And people become resistant to chemotherapy. That's why they often have to take multiple lines of chemo, and eventually there's nothing left in the arsenal because people develop resistance to them.
It's like killing bacteria. Anything you do to try to kill a population of billions of cells, you know, there's always the chance that some are going to evolve the way out of that, and then you
and then cancer is like almost by definition a superbug. It's your own cells. It's a superbug version of your own cells.
Yeah, just breaking out of all of the inherent limits that are supposed to be there to keep this from happening, right?
Yeah.
This should be one more powerful tool, you know, in our toolbox, so very encouraging. All right, Bob, tell us about planets spiraling into their sun.
Yes. Which one?
Oh.
Not ours.
No, well, not soon.
thank goodness.
So scientists did some science-y things recently and proposed some cool scientific theories.
Yep, that's a short version.
That's it.
Yep.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's all you get.
Generic. In this case, it involves a hot Jupiter exoplanet slowly death spiraling towards its star, which could help us determine the ultimate fate of Earth and many other planets. This was a study published in the Astrophysical Journal Letters, and the planet, the exoplanet in question is called Kepler 1658b, which orbits which star?
Alpha something.
No, you should know from the name.
Oh, sorry.
Well,
Kepler.
If the planet is Kepler 1658b, the star is Kepler 1658.
A is always the star, and the first planet is B, and so on.
What's a binary system?
Yeah,
A and
the
B.
Stars are
A1,
A2? No, it's A
and
B.
Okay.
Alpha, beta.
The star name that I saw was just Kepler 658. I thought the same thing, Steve, that the A is for the star itself, but this one is the star is 1658. It doesn't matter, though. As the name confirms, it was discovered by the famous Kepler Space Telescope. It's 2,600 light years from Earth, and it's about almost six times the mass of Jupiter. And as I said, it's a hot Jupiter. We've talked about that a few times. Hot Jupiters have a couple of defining characteristics.
Very sexy.
They have a very large... good one. They have a very large mass. Their masses range from about a third of a Jupiter mass to about almost 12 Jupiter masses. And they've got short orbital periods, 1.3 to 111 Earth days.
Yeah, but we don't hold that against them.
No. And they're often tidally locked as well. But typically, though, they're huge and they're close to their star. And because they're huge, they're gas giants. So Kepler 1658b has a year that is 3.8 days long. 3.8 day year. So this is Thursday night, right? So remember last Monday? Well, that was last year if you lived on this planet. So, but that year though is more unusual than just because it's super short compared to our year, which really doesn't mean anything. The anomaly about a 3.8 day year is that it's getting shorter regularly by about around 131 milliseconds a year. So every year, an Earth year, it loses 131,000th of a second in its orbit. Now, if you calculate that out, that inward spiral will continue. If it continues, it will impact the star in 3 million years. So it's like, you know, who cares? It's a little change. 3 million years is so far in the future, but there's so many interesting ramifications to that. Shreyas Visapragada is a postdoc at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics and the study lead author, said, this is the first time we observed direct evidence for a planet spiraling towards its evolved star. I had never heard that expression before, an evolved star. I mean, you can kind of guess what it means. I figured, oh, it's just an older star. But specifically, that means that it's mature, obviously, but it's all the hydrogen has been fused into helium. So it's basically like the next stage of its life. And it's started expanding into what's called a subgiant. So it's those kind of stars that we have never seen any planet spiraling in towards that kind of planet, which is important. That this can tell you, you know, about the end life of a planet because the star is now in its end, you know, its end life. So now this is happening, scientists believe, because of one of my top four favorite forces, tidal forces. We've mentioned tidal forces.
Was that blank? He was waiting for us to guess, wasn't he?
He wanted us to yell.
He didn't give me
it. It was a joke. Right. It was a joke. So this is so that's essentially
3/4 of a second.
Tidal force is essentially the difference in gravity strength from one point to another. So the moon tugs on the near side of the Earth more than the far side because it's closer. So you may think, hey, Bob, I've heard you described so eloquently in the past that tidal forces are driving our moon away from us, not toward us. What's the deal? Ah, good point, mental listener. You are correct. As tidal forces, it is fascinating just unto itself. As tidal forces slow Earth's rotation, making our days longer, there's a concomitant increase in the orbital distance of the moon. It's like stealing energy from the Earth, so it's got to go farther away. So, but that can happen the other way, the opposite way too. Tidal interactions are very complex. In some scenarios, especially if it's a star-planet scenario, tidal forces are predicted to make the smaller body get closer and closer, decaying the orbit. And these scientists theorize that that's exactly what's happening for Kepler-1658b. Theories have predicted it, and we're not sure exactly of the details. And now we've got like this laboratory in space showing us that it's happening. And I was going through the paper, interesting paper. The parts that I could actually make sense of regarding this specific point was fascinating. So check this out. So the smaller and smaller orbits require less energy, right? If you push something, if you give energy to something in orbit and it takes that energy, it's going to go into a higher orbit. But if you're taking away energy, then where's that energy going to go? It's going to go into a smaller orbit, but where is that energy going? So apparently the star could be dissipating that energy or the planet can be dissipating the energy. Those are the two theories. One of them is taking that energy, and they think in this case that the star is dissipating that energy in processes that are very difficult to figure out. But they've determined that the star is soaking up that energy of the planet, and which is making it go into a smaller and smaller orbit. But the planet is also dissipating a little bit of it, like 10% of that energy. And that's why they think that this planet is so bright. They think it could be 4,700 degrees Fahrenheit, or 2,500 degrees Celsius. It's really, really hot. And they think it's because of that. It's taking some of the energy that it's losing going into smaller and smaller orbits. So that was really interesting. Now, of course, this decaying orbit is of extra interest to us. Why? Because it's nice to know, you know, what Earth's fate is going to be in the distant future, right? So regarding that, Vasa Brigada said, while the tidally driven processes seen on Kepler-1658b will drive the decay of the Earth's orbit towards the sun, that effect could be counterbalanced by the sun losing mass. The ultimate fate of the Earth is somewhat unclear. Yeah, we're not sure exactly what's going to happen, you know, to the Earth in billions of years when the sun really buys the farm. Are we going to collide with it? Are we going to get just burnt to a crisp? Are we going to actually get into a higher orbit because, you know, the sun is losing mass and its gravity is going to go to, I don't know. They're not 100% sure what's going to go on. So in the future, what's going on in the future with this? Regarding that specifically, Visit Brigada said, now that we have evidence of inspiraling of planets around an evolved star, we can really start to refine our models of tidal physics. The Kepler-1658 system can serve as a celestial laboratory in this way for years to come. And with any luck, there will soon be many more of these labs. So once we learn more about such systems, we may eventually figure out with a much higher level of confidence than we have now, the fate of many planets in many solar systems, including, of course, the ultimate fate of Earth, which is pretty cool. Interesting aside, this planet, Kepler-1658b, the very first exoplanet candidate spotted by Kepler telescope, which was launched in 2009. It took 10 years for them to realize, oh, this exoplanet candidate is actually a full-fledged exoplanet. So it was the first one that it identified, and it took all this time to figure it out. It's really hard to spot such a minute amount of orbital decay, especially when it's so far away. 4,200 light years?
What happened to the notion that our sun will expand in 4 billion years and engulf the Earth before it has a chance to, say, spiral away into it?
Yep, it's definitely going to be doing that. It'll reach its own, you know, subgiant phase, and it's going to balloon out its outer layers, and it's going to lose a lot of some of that mass. So yeah, that's going to happen. But you know what's going to happen to the Earth when that happens? We're not clear. And this may help us determine the ultimate fate of the Earth.
All right, Evan, you're going to do a dumbest thing of the week.
That's right. Back by popular demand. Oh, and speaking of popular demand.
Really? We have
what are we going to disappoint? The all those people who wrote in
and expressed
their desire to have me sing the official theme song for Dumbest Thing of the Week? I will not deny them. Here we go. It's the dumbest thing of the week. It's the dumbest thing of I speak. In a world full of fools, this story rules. The dumbest thing of the week. Thank you very much. Thank you. Steve, can you find some music to kind of act as a backing trip for that?
I could.
You'll work on it. We'll talk after. I first saw this this news item written up in the New York Post. All right, New York Post, get it. But in the days following, many other news outlets wrote their own reports on the matter. However, none of them properly categorized it as the dumbest thing of the week, so I'm here to fix that. This was back January 4th. The journalist's name, Andrew Court. Here's his headline. Potatoes in socks. Flu remedy shocks TikTok. What came out of my body? ? That's the headline. All right. So TikTok users are sleeping with slices of potatoes in their socks in a desperate bid to beat the flu.
What?
Yeah. So it's called potato sock, or what, hashtag potato sock, if you care to look this up on TikTok. And hundreds of clips showing social media users trying out this health hack, as they call it. I don't have TikTok on my phone. But I did watch the videos, you know, using my conventional computer. I did not open an account. I didn't do any of that. But it is there. Anyone can go. Hashtag potato sock. And I think it's done a good job of tagging some of the most gullible people on TikTok. And before I start, I want to say this. First, if you watch these videos, and I watched, about 30 of them. I watched 30 of these things. Zero actual skepticism to be found. But almost 100% pseudo-skepticism to be found. And what I mean by pseudo-skepticism is that at some point in the video, somebody says, well, I was skeptical at first, but then I tried it myself, and now I believe. That's pseudo-skepticism. Here, and like it says, people are doing this. First, you slice a potato. Then you put it on your foot. Then you cover it with a sock. And you go to sleep. If you're sick, you're going to wake up, and you're going to feel much better. Natural way of fighting the flu. Some people absolutely swear by this practice. That has helped potatoes draw the toxins out of their body, which is clearly what was causing their flu and their cold and feeling miserable. But now they feel fresh and energized. Thank goodness for the almighty potato. Here is a quote. It works. My daughter has been feeling so much better, one mother exclaimed after testing the trick on her sick child. And it's the only true part about this, the trick. Her video has garnered more than 6.6 million views. I think it was up to 7 million the other day. But when this was published, it was 6.6 million views. And with a set of instructions on how to correctly complete this remedy. You take a potato, cut 2 slices out of it, put them beneath the sole of each foot, and cover them with a sock overnight. You're going to see an imprint on the bottom of your foot, which is totally fine. Don't worry. Then you're going to see the potato slices, which are disgustingly dark. That's because the toxins are removed and your child will feel so much better.
My God.
Here's another person showing the blackened potato slices. Whatever it pulled out of my body, it worked. I feel so much better.
Wait, has that person never put just a sliced potato on the countertop and seen what happens to it?
Oh, and believe me, some of these potato videos on TikTok, potato sock videos, they did just that, Kara. They had the control group, shall we say, of the slices just sitting out on the plate overnight compared to what they put on their, you know, sweaty feet in a nice warm sock that they slept with overnight. And oh my goodness, you should see the one on the counter only browned a little bit, but the one that came off their stinking foot in the morning with the hot humidity in the body and the warmth, everything, it was 12 more shades darker than the control. Tell me what, you know, how
do you explain that?
How the heck do you explain
tides come
that?
In, the tides come, you can't explain that.
Medical experts are warning TikTokers, too late, to not do this, because, you know, there are obviously more real things you can do to alleviate your flu symptoms, not to mention it adds to people's misunderstanding about, you know, bodily functions, how it deals with viruses, basically the whole can of misinformation that you wind up consuming when you start doing these kinds of things will pour over into your other areas of cognitive reasoning and decision making. So yeah, don't do this. They said, Dr. Tommy Martin, this does not substitute seeing a doctor if your child is ill, right? I mean, you're supposed to be taking care of your children responsibly, not slapping pieces of potato on their feet and thinking that that's doing anything for their health. A potato in a sock is not going to cure your flu. Here's what else he says. The mind always goes to what's next, what's down the pipe. And I encourage people to not think of these things as a one-off. Like, oh, thank goodness we were past the NyQuil chicken. That was a thing, I think, last year, perhaps the year before, not combining NyQuil with chicken. And gosh.
Oh, my God.
There's a pattern of medical misinformation that could be pretty damaging long-term. Yes, very well said, I think. So, and of course, the reason potato is brown is because of the oxidation. So, you know, no surprise there. This does have a long history to it. People have been, you know, putting potatoes and onions, it turns out, on their feet for a very long time. This isn't anything new that just crept up with the new year in 2023. There have been videos about this made for many years. You can go through YouTube, but also they say it dates way, way back. Even beyond that, you know, back to what the Middle Ages and beyond, where people were doing all sorts of things, but, you know, attaching all sorts of vegetables when they didn't know about germ theory and how viruses work and so many other things in life. Desperate people dying of all sorts of nasty stuff. Sure, you had a kind of a reason almost to try almost anything, a home remedy or something that your ancient wisdom from your family was passed down from generation to generation. Understood. That's not today, though. And, you know, clearly that's a major problem. I did find something else, though. Now, there were people who would put potatoes, okay, whole potatoes, not slices of potatoes.
In their ass.
In their socks. But for a reason, for a practical reason, as warmers. They would heat up the potato, basically, right, as if you were to cook the potato, and you can wrap it in a cloth or do something else. And if you were cold at night, you would then take that potato, put it at your feet, and put a sock over it or some sort of fabric over it, and it would help keep your feet warm. Okay, so now we're actually talking about something that actually makes sense. You know, they didn't say it was going to cure your flu or anything, but you can almost kind of see how perhaps this evolved maybe over time. Maybe it wasn't slices of potato. It started with the whole, you know, hey, warm potato on your feet, keep you, you know, warm at night means, you know, you just were more comfortable or, you know, you just felt better even when you were feeling bad or suffering with some sort of cold, flu, or what have you. And then there was also this, and I'll wrap up with this. In my research into this, ever wonder why we call potatoes spuds?
No.
Mm.
Well, here we go. As folk etymology has it, there was once a group of activists who formed the Society for the Prevention of an Unwholesome Diet, SPUD. They suspected the potato of being unfit for the diet of British people aimed to ban it from Britain. Consequently, the humble potato was given its nickname Spud, S-P-U-D, Society for Prevention of Unwholesome Diet. So this was written in 1949, but it was made up, obviously. You know, it's like poking fun, having fun with it. But it did appear in a book, and it's like, okay, so what? Is this the original? Is this the original origin of Spud? So you go a little bit deeper into it. No, that's not. Obviously, it wasn't there. It goes back even before that. Spuds reach back to the 15th century, where a spud, S-P-U-D-D-E, or spood, was a small, sharp gardening tool for digging holes and digging up weeds. In the mid-19th century, people used the term spud to mean potato. First recorded use, New Zealand, 1845. But also, spud can mean a hole in a sock. Oh. It took on, at some point, this whole potato and sock thing has this history to it. What the hell were people doing with all the potatoes in their socks? It seems like a phenomenon that was going on for many hundreds of years in all different kinds of way. But spud apparently is slang for a hole in a sock. So there you go. A little more connection with socks and potatoes during my research. But regardless of all that, treating your flu symptoms with potatoes in your socks, that definitely qualifies as the dumbest thing of the week.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, I mean, comments, there's a lot of competition, but sure.
6.6 million views. Oh, gosh.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. So I got a lot of people writing in jokes
because it's funny.
Because apparently a lot of people thought that was me. I got two serious submissions out of all the joke emails I got. Okay. I got two serious submissions. Only two. What happened? All right. So here we go. Frederick Neant wrote in and said, "Hello, skeptics. Based on the reaction of my dove and having raised them, it sounds very similar to the vocalization of a large baby rock dove." And then he put in, like, quotes, pigeon. "Specifically around the time when their adult feathers sprout and they start walking around my balcony. Regards." So you got to correct that this is an animal, but it is not a bird. And my second guess came in from Visto Tutti, because he guesses pretty much every week. And he said, "I have no clue, but my dog reacts like it's a baby mammal. He always wants to eat baby mammals. I'm just going to throw a dart, and it lands on a baby ferret." That is actually not a bad guess. I used to have a ferret, and they do make really cute noises when they run.
But ooh, they smell.
And a ferret is actually not a bad guess at all, because...
Is it a mammal?
It's a mammal.
Jay, do you remember my ferret? Remember his name?
Yeah, Lotus Luell.
Lotus Luell Muad'Dib.
Anybody want to guess what animal this is?
Good Skeptics Guide trivia. What was the name of Bob's ferret?
Oh, wow. That's definitely a lot of points.
Okay, you said a ferret is a good guess.
Yes.
So it's something like a ferret.
A weasel?
No, it's probably not that simple. Like a raccoon or something?
It's a striped skunk. It's a skunk.
That's
a skunk.
Skunks make amazingly cute noises. Listen again.
Yeah, but nobody knows because they can't get close enough to hear them.
I've seen a skunk up really, really close, and they're really cute. Like, if it weren't for the fact that they skunk, they would be like,
well, people
awesome.
Remove their glands and then you have them as pets, and they are cute.
All right, listen again. It sounds like a joke. They're adorable. Come on. Imagine having one in your house that's running around like cackling like that all the time.
So, I would not be in that house. I wouldn't know.
So you never know with Who's That Noisy. You might think, oh my God, so many people are writing and sometimes I don't get that many guesses, and I could be reading your guess on the SGU.
This was a huge opportunity.
Yeah, you missed it. And I don't know. Maybe they just thought it was too – I don't know. It's just weird. I wonder why we didn't get more guesses. But it was a cute little skunk, a striped skunk. We used to have a standard poodle growing up, and I saw him get sprayed by skunks multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when Killer got sprayed by a skunk once, it was so
brutal.
I got
the tomato juice. I don't know if it worked. I mean, just had to wait. Really.
What, the tomato juice thing?
Right.
Tomato juice, that was our thing.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
Well, yeah.
I know this for a fact.
Killer. Ooh, you scienced it?
Well, Killer got sprayed. It was atrocious. I ran upstairs. First thing in my head, I'll grab a can of tomato juice. Didn't have any, but I had like SpaghettiOs.
Oh my god. Kara, this is your scientific determination that it doesn't work?
No, so then I called the vet, and I was like, hey, my dog got sprayed point blank, like 1 foot away. His eyes are swelling.
In the mouth, probably.
Yeah, and I was spraying water in his eyes, and he smelled horrible. And she was, and I was like, I put tomato juice. She was like, that's so stupid. I'm going to send you a recipe for what you need to do. And I was like, should I bring him in? I'm afraid his eyes are injured. And she was like, I was like, I'm doing a consistent eye wash. I'm going to do it for a full hour. And she was like, if you come in, you'll be paying us to do the same thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So keep doing that. And only if he seems like he's having vision problems, he can't see, they're like crusting shut, then you can bring him in later. But do that. And then she gave me the recipe for the bath that you're supposed to use, which, if I'm remembering correctly, is like dish soap, baking soda, and hydrogen peroxide.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hydrogen peroxide. Yeah.
Yeah.
And tomato juice.
But, no tomato juice. And apparently, you can't leave it on that long because it actually bleaches their skin or their fur.
Yeah.
So you have to be a little bit careful about that if you have a pet with dark fur.
Yeah. That's a thing you don't want to deal with. Trust me.
Oh, it's gross.
I got a new noisy this week sent in by a listener named Gary Groves. And check this one out.
Now that's a UFO.
Clearly.
Oh, yeah.
It totally reminds me of a movie from the 70s. Can you guys guess what it is?
From the 70s?
Yep.
You're not thinking of Forbidden Planet, are you?
No. Mm. No, that's all Fehrman.
No.
It sounds like Logan's Run a little bit.
Oh, yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
All right. So if you guys think you know what this week's noisy is, or if you heard something cool, don't forget, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Steve.
Yes.
Couple of things. So sure. 2023 is here. As you know, because I've been talking to you, I have all sorts of plans. We are going to be doing multiple live stream events this year. All of them are going to start with at least a full hour of content only for patrons, which I'm very excited about because we've had lots of fun patron live stream things happen. Watermelon, you know.
Ian.
So we want more fun stuff like that. So we'll be doing some fun stuff, like kind of like offbeat stuff, not like just news items. You know, we're going to be doing like crazy stuff for just to entertain them and have fun and have, you know, I want to have patrons on. I want to like interview more patrons and stuff. You know, we've met quite a few and we did a lot on the, you know, Friday live streams. We had patrons on quite a bit on there. Mm-hmm. We had a ton of fun. So I'd like to do more of that. So yeah. So if you want to do that show and you want to see that 1 hour, you got to become a patron. I'll give you more details as we go, and I'll be putting out a calendar of when these shows are going to happen. But we'll do 3 or 4 this year. And other stuff that we're planning that we can't say, but I can tell you this.
Jay.
Yes.
There's a lot of nonsense on TikTok, as Evan just said.
Exactly. That's what I'm talking about. There is so much stupid stuff on TikTok. What could be done?
What can we do?
Somebody do something.
What could we set loose on TikTok to whack back the insanity? How about Dr. Stephen Novella on TikTok?
Yeah, I guess.
All right.
If you go to Skeptic's Guide on TikTok, you could see Steve literally talking about videos that we found on TikTok where Steve is talking about why they happen to be incorrect in some of the statements that they're saying. We had a ton of fun, man. That was so much fun.
Like, it was fun.
We had a whole. We're going to do this every week. So here's the jam. Every week, Ian, Steve, and I are going to get together, and we'll have curated some of our crazier things that we found that week, and Steve is going to refute them.
And you could send us recommendations.
Yeah, so email us at info@theskepticsguide.org if you find anything that you think would be fun for Steve to discuss. And then another thing that we're doing is we are going to be doing a weekly YouTube video on a single topic. You know, right now it's me and Steve. You know, the lineup might change. Basically, you know, I am asking Steve a science question and Steve gives me a very detailed answer and we, you know, and pandemonium ensues, right? We're just going to talk and, you know, wherever the conversation goes, it goes. And of course, you'll be able to see that on the SGU YouTube channel. That will be live as you hear this. That'll be up on the internet. But the TikTok stuff is up and more to be added every week.
Yeah, and these are evolving ideas. So, you know, we're just, you know, what Jay and I have learned over the years is that you just have to start doing stuff. You can't tweak the hell out of them first because you'll never do it. and then you could tweak them as you go.
Yeah, right? We'll iterate, of course. But you know, we know that if we're laughing and we're having fun and like we're discussing it, that we figure, you know, the audience will kind of do the same thing. Yeah.
Thanks, Jay. We're going to do one email this week, and this email is part of the reason why I wanted to answer this question is because it has a lot of overlap with the Roman concrete news item, some common themes. All right, so this email comes from John Mullen from North Ireland, and he writes, I have listened to every episode, huge fan. I have never heard you guys talk about the Damascus steel debate. This comes up frequently when people on YouTube or in blacksmithing TV shows make steel cut and folded into ornate patterns. It is referred to as Damascus steel. Then the nerds come out of the woodwork. Actually, the technique to making true Damascus steel has been lost to time, and modern attempts are nowhere near as strong. From a material science standpoint, is there any truth to the claim that ancient Damascus is a better material for sword making than modern Damascus? It seems almost a given that with modern metallurgy, knowledge, equipment, and techniques that we can make a better steel and still have a signature pattern visible after polishing. What do you guys think? Thanks for the great show. P.S. I wheezed when I heard Avatar described as Dances with Smurfs. All right, so there's a lot to unpack here. I'm going to try to make this as efficient as I can. So Damascus steel is actually two kinds of Damascus steel. They're in both are have been around for a very long time. The original Damascus steel, meaning the older one, is a type of steel that has the surface looks almost like flowing water. Right, because it has a kind of a pattern on the surface of the steel that makes it look like it's flowing. So this was produced from about 600 AD to about 1750 AD, and it was stronger, you know, better quality, better for weapons than any other steel at the time. So I think that's what most people think of when they think of like ancient Damascus steel. Modern Damascus steel is more accurately referred to as forged Damascus, but people just call it Damascus for shorthand. And what that is when you take two different types of steel and you forge weld them together and you fold them over and you do that multiple times, and it creates a very similar looking pattern, this wavy water-like pattern in the steel. It's actually very pretty. And then you can compare ancient Damascus to forged Damascus to just modern monosteel, what we call it monosteel, meaning it's just one steel, not multiple steels forged together. Which one would have the better quality, be better for sword making? There's also the question in there of, was the knowledge to make the ancient Damascus steel lost to modern times? And the answer to that is, well, yes and no. For a while, because, you know, the people who were making the Damascus steel, it was kind of a trade secret, so it wasn't widely, like, the knowledge of exactly what to do was not widely available. And it was similar to the concrete. I don't know that the people who were making it actually knew what was happening at, like, a molecular level. So they might not. All they knew is if we do this specific thing, we get the results that we want, but they didn't necessarily know why, and therefore it was hard to export. Does that make sense? So let me get into why the ancient Damascus steel was so good. So first of all, it's derived from a specific source of steel from India called Wootz, W-O-O-T-Z, Wootz steel, or Wootz, whatever. And so you had to use that as your source of steel. It would come in ingots, right? And then they had to go through a process, right, where they heat it to a specific temperature. They had to heat it with other material in order to, like a source of carbon, to get the carbon content very high. They would heat it for a long time, which would work out a lot of the impurities. So it had several characteristics that made the steel very high quality. It was high carbon steel. It was low impurity. And it was using the specific stock of steel that maybe, you know, had certain alloys in it, you know, that was responsible for the quality of the steel. So this was a thing that really wasn't known after, basically they said after guns were around, like the sword making industry was not as robust, and then the exact knowledge of the technique was lost. But in the 1990s, researchers basically figured out how to make Damascus steel. Basically, to add what I said, what they discovered was that the wood steel has a very small amount of vanadium in it. And vanadium is known as a good alloy for steel, which makes it very strong. What they didn't realize that even a tiny amount, like 0.02%, you know, alloy, allows for a certain crystal structure in the steel that gives it that wavy pattern, and also causes like an interlocking of the crystals of the carbon and iron that give it its not only its hardness but its strength. You know, it allows it to be very malleable, but also hold an edge very well and be very, very strong. So they basically reverse engineered ancient Damascus steel. And what's interesting, because like as with the concrete, it's that tiny impurity in the steel that turned out to be a critical ingredient. Mm-hmm. That's why you needed to source from that particular source of iron, because it had that small amount of vanadium in it. It turns out to be a critical alloy. And then probably just through trial and error, they figured out, oh, we have to heat it to this much for this period of time. And, you know, the heating process is critical to making steel, like to the resulting property of steels. How high you heat it, for how long, and how quickly you cool it down. When you're making hardened steel, you know, it has to have a certain carbon content, and then you have to quench it, which means you cool it down very, very quickly. This is like what you always see, like they dunk the steel in the water and it steams.
That's not just a cool effect.
Yeah, but the thing is, you would never do that. Like, you wouldn't quench it in water, because that's a good
way. Yeah, that seems too Hollywood.
It's a good way to destroy the steel, because it would create a lot of cracks into it. It'd make it really hard. Like, it's super fast way to cool it down. I remember in Conan the Barbarian, they quenched it in snow. Like, that would destroy the steel. So right,
look cool, though.
It looks cool. So typically, you quench in oil that's at a certain temperature, so it cools down just the right amount, but not so much that it gets, because, you know, the harder it gets, the more brittle it gets. When you quench in water, it makes it brittle, and you run the risk of it cracking and breaking. Not good for a sword. Not that you can't ever do it. It's just like wouldn't be standard procedure for making weapons, you know. Modern Damascus, you take modern steels, but with different alloys, usually different amounts of nickel, so they look a little bit different, and then you fold them together and acid etch them so that you could see the different layers of steel. And it's basically for aesthetics, because it looks beautiful. But you can use these techniques in order to give different parts of the sword, you want the spine to be strong but not hard, and you want the edge to be hard so it can hold an edge. So that way you might want different parts of your tool or your weapon or whatever to have different types of steel. And you could use Damascus as a technique for that. Or you could just use you could just layer the steels. You know, you don't have to do like a specifically a Damascus pattern. Now, there's one other type of steel that often gets thrown into the mix, and that's Japanese steel, because they famously would fold their steel over and over and over again, a million folds. You keep doubling the number of folds every time you fold it. And the reason for that was to work out the impurities, because the impurities are weak spots. Right, and you could have one little grain of impurity in a sword, and that's where it breaks. And of course, that's a disaster if you're fighting with that sword. So having like really working out all the impurities is critical. But here's the thing: modern steel, modern industrial steel, blows away every type of older steel.
Boom.
Like any ancient steel, whether it's Damascus or Japanese steel, whatever, modern steel just blows it away. And because we have it down to a science. Because the steel that we make today has virtually no impurities in it, right? And so all the shit that you do to get rid of the impurities, it's done. If you buy a chunk of modern industrial steel, there's no impurities in there. And then also we have the alloying technology down. Not that we're not still making discoveries, but there are like thousands of types of steel based upon different alloys, we can get, you know, consistent, you know, to like the decimal point amount of carbon in it, which is critical. And also when they heat and cool it, they're doing it to specific temperatures. If you look at like, you know, instructions of how to make Damascus steel, whatever, they say, heat it until it glows with the light of the setting sun, right? That was their technology at the time. Now we just use like, you know, temperature guns, and we heat it to a specific temperature.
Right? Fraction of a degree.
Yeah, it's like it's dialed in.
Wavelength with this many nanometers.
Yeah, right. It's dialed in to a significant degree. It just, again, it's just much better than any older technology. This idea that the ancients are making better steel than we are today is just not true. Yeah.
Old stuff sucks.
I mean,
that's right, Bob. You tell them.
Through trial and error and a lot of work, they made really good steel. But again, it's just nothing compared to what we can do today. Like actually understanding the science of alloying and carbon and getting the impurities out, et cetera. It's just, you know, just much more scientific, much more powerful. So that's at the end of the long explanation, but at the end of the day, the answer is modern steels are better.
Yeah, very long.
Much better. Okay. Everyone, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Just three regular news items this week. You guys
in
ready?
27 parts.
All right, here we go. Item number one. Recent research demonstrates that with as few as three genetic changes, human hemoglobin can be made to function similarly to crocodilian hemoglobin, allowing for extended periods on a single breath of air. All right, number two. Researchers have developed artificial biorealistic nerve cells capable of communicating using ions and stimulating living nerves. And item number three, an international team of scientists have found that there are millions of abandoned mines worldwide that can be converted into grid storage units with as much as 70 terawatt hours of storage, about one day of world energy use. Evan, go first.
Okay, I'm honored. First of all, thank you very much.
Sure.
I don't know. What? All right. Number one, as few as three genetic changes, human hemoglobin can be made to function similarly to crocodilian hemoglobin, allowing for extended periods on a single breath of air. Three genetic changes and boom, human hemoglobin turns into crocodile hemoglobin. Can it be that few? Maybe. It sounds remarkable, but...
Remarkable.
I mean, you know, right? We've learned about how close we are to, you know, chimps and, you know, just like a couple of things that... Small things that just differentiate us, but... And I know a crocodile seems like, you know, wow, no way, not even close to a human, but I don't know. I think more and more we're surprised at just how connected we are, like... Not built that dissimilarly to things that appear to be dissimilar. So I think that one's plausible. The next one about artificial biorealistic nerve cells capable of communicating using ions, okay, and stimulating living nerves. So maybe that's the key there. It's probably too simplistic to say, well, it's just signaling. Why couldn't that be the case? There's something in there about... that artificial over to living nerves.
Well, what do you specifically mean by biorealistic?
I mean, there's a... I will give you a technical definition, but you'll have to go with it for now.
And then the last one where a team of scientists found that there are millions of abandoned mines worldwide. There's millions of those things? That in itself is...
Yeah, right?
Kind of amazing, I think. But you can convert them into grid storage units? What? Convert... Like they just house... The machinery or the whatever you put in there, convert into grids into storage. And okay, well, that doesn't sound too implausible. Just the fact that there are millions of abandoned mines. So okay, crocodile hemoglobin. I don't know. there's something with that one that's a little weirder than the other one about the nerve cells. So I guess I'll go with that. Crocodile hemoglobin is fiction.
Okay, Kara.
Yeah, they're all weird. They all seem, I don't know. The nerve cell one, I want to be true. So, and it doesn't, I feel like there's something that Evan said, which I kind of agree with. Like, it seems like it's all too simple, but it's just signaling. And yes, I think inside of a nerve cell, all of these like really complicated metabolic and like molecular machines are going on. But ultimately, ions are flowing in, ions are flowing out. It's going to fire. If it fires, it's going to basically tell the muscle to twitch. I could see this working, especially in like vitro. The scientists who have found that there are millions of abandoned mines worldwide that can be converted into grid storage units. Sure. You guys are like so obsessed with grid storage. We talk about this all the time. I feel like I should know more about it. But we are often talking about like the only limitation is how much land mass we have to use, or like where could this go? How would we do this? And so cool. There's already a bunch of like stuff that's not being used that we could shove it into. I like it. So I think I'm going to go with Evan on this because I can't imagine that the only reason a crocodile can live underwater for that long is because it has some cool hemoglobin. I mean, it's probably one of many reasons, but I don't think that all of a sudden, if we just changed a few things in our hemoglobin, we would become like sea people. it just doesn't seem realistic to me. So I think I've got to go with Evan on that.
Phew.
Okay, Bob.
I feel better.
I'm gonna say that the hemoglobin one is science. I would think hemoglobin would be highly conserved. The genetic structure of hemoglobin would be highly conserved because it's pretty important. You don't want to mess with that too much. It's doing a good job. So to me, it makes sense that it would only be a few genetic changes away. I suspect that we couldn't, you know, change ours to that type of hemoglobin very easily. And I'm sure there would be huge other downsides that make it totally and impractical. But the fact that, which is the thrust of number one, is there's three differences. I totally buy that. I mean, sometimes that's all it takes. So it's just a small amount of changes. Yeah. That one made the most sense to me. I mean, I got a little pause since Evan and Kara selected it, but tough crap. The biorealistic nerve cells. I was surprised that Kara wasn't too surprised with that, the feasibility of that. That sounds pretty amazing. But yeah, maybe it's in vitro and maybe what kind of ions? Maybe there's an ion issue that's different, that's incompatible. But it seems like a pretty damn big breakthrough. So for that reason, and I bet this is wrong, the stupid mine one and the grid storage, I'm just going to say that's fiction just to spite Steve.
Wow.
Because I know he does it.
Yeah, the first one about the hemoglobin, you know, I have to admit, I just don't know enough about you know, the genetic, the capabilities of the, you know, what are they using to do this? Is it CRISPR or whatever? Like, you know, with CRISPR, it just seems like so much has become accessible that wasn't accessible just a few years ago. So, I mean, it would be really silly to just say that one isn't science. I think that one is likely to be science. You know, the one thing about the item number two here, about the artificial biorealistic nerve cells, I mean, I thought we were at the level where we were stimulating the brain on a much higher altitude, you know, not like down to the neuronal level. But again, I don't see why, like Kara said, we couldn't be doing something like this as a test in the lab. And I could really see it. I think that we might be able to do something like this at this point. You know, apparently, there's something big about it using ions to communicate. I don't get that. That's a really big, I really want that to be science because that sounds like they would have crazy applications. Now, this third one, I don't like the whole idea that there's millions of minds. Like, I could see a use for minds. I could see them, you know, like, you know how we were talking about, were you saying forced hydro, Steve? Pumped hydro?
Pumped hydro, closed loop pumped hydro.
Yeah, closed loop pumped hydro.
I remember
like
that.
Like, they might, you know, maybe they found a way to use these mines, you know, if they're capable of holding water, you know. You know, there's also like the salt battery. You know, maybe they're going to fill them up with sand or something, like somebody said, and you know, use it to store heat. But millions of mines, I mean, god damn, that's a lot. Millions of abandoned mines worldwide that can be converted. I can't see that. I mean, even with as giant as the Earth is, you know, if you just break it down, like, let's say in the United States, like, how many mines would there have to be in each state? You know, it just doesn't seem plausible that there's that many mines. Just on that one thing wow. alone, I'm going to say that that can't be science.
Okay. All right, so let's start with number two, since you all agree with this one. Researchers have developed artificial biorealistic nerve cells capable of communicating using ions and stimulating living cells. You guys all living think nerves. This is science, and this one is science.
Oh, my God. How very cool is that?
That's amazing. That's pretty
very
cool.
Yeah. Here is the title of the article, Ion Tunable Anti-ambipolarity in Mixed Ion Electron Conducting Polymers Enables Biorealistic Organic Electrochemical Neurons.
Of course. Oh, the really lay public will eat that up.
So are they actually forming synapses?
Pretty much.
That's
and
cool.
They fire in a biorealistic way. So they, you know, they have the spikes at frequencies around 100 hertz.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the thing, Kara, they like activate the channels on the nerves,
yeah,
right?
It's not just really cool.
Like just ephaptically. Ephaptic means it's not going through any biological pathway. It's just you could like shock anything. Like I could shock you anywhere.
Of course, but this is actually telling the postsynaptic neuron
exactly,
to. Oh,
yeah.
That's really
what,
cool.
So now, what can't it do?
You asked. Well, you know, I don't want to get too much into the weeds, but just to give you the big view, they said there are 20 characteristics that scientists came up with to say this is what a biorealistic neuron would look like. This one has 15 of the 20.
What?
So nice.
The previous iteration had like two, you know? So this is a huge advance.
So, but the weird thing is it's internal, I'm guessing, its internal architecture is nothing like a cell.
No, it's a polymer.
Right,
know?
It's just like a little bit of plastic.
It's just plastic.
But when it... Secretes.
It's organic polymer. That's it. But they structured it so that it can, conduct electricity and spike in a realistic
Steve,
way.
Can
and
I hook
also
this thing up to a computer?
Release ions.
I mean, is this
the idea is to make to make this into circuits. You know,
holy and Christ, this is
you could
big.
also use this to communicate with the brain, right? You want the squishy mm-hmm. electrodes, right?
Right?
This would be an interface between the brain. And
oh, this is cool. I wonder if you could bypass like damaged.
Yeah,
pathways.
That's the other thing.
Yeah,
they used
yeah.
it. The nerve they tested it on was the vagus nerve. They basically were able to stimulate the vagus nerve.
So it was like it was about gambling. Then what are you talking about?
Yeah, VAGUS.
So, but that's kind of like it's a more like gross application than
yeah.
stimulating individual cells. Like getting
yeah.
a whole nerve to react is a little bit more, but still that's freaking awesome. I mean, that's why when I
it's
read it,
advance.
I thought it was a muscle twitch. Cause that seems like that's what I would start with is
yeah.
the neuromuscular junction.
It's a good advance. And
yeah, it's cool.
It shows you where the technology is headed. Okay. Let's go back to number one. Recent research demonstrates that with as few as 3 genetic changes, human hemoglobin can be made to function similarly to crocodilian hemoglobin, allowing for extended periods on a single breath of air. Bob and Jay think this one is science. Evan and Kara think this one is fiction. And this one is the fiction.
Oh, man.
Sorry, guys. But not really for the reason that you guys think, or at least Nate. So can crocodiles hold their breath for a long time because of their hemoglobin?
Yeah.
Yes. That's exactly why they can
survive. Is that the only reason?
It's the primary reason, Kara.
No,
this is
that's amazing.
Their hemoglobin is awesome. So let me tell you how it works.
Super hemoglobin.
Vertebrate hemoglobin. So hemoglobin is the molecule in red blood cells that binds oxygen from your lungs and then delivers it, you know, through the blood to the tissue, and the tissues can extract the oxygen from the hemoglobin, right? So essentially, the hemoglobin has a very high affinity for oxygen, but cells need to have something that has a higher affinity for that oxygen so it could pull it from the hemoglobin. For most vertebrates, that is phosphate groups, right? So it uses phosphates to bind to the oxygen. And it does that very well, right? So the whole system works incredibly well, and it's very conserved, as Bob said. But crocodiles, the crocodilians, that whole group, managed to evolve a completely separate system. It's still, so their hemoglobin binds oxygen like normal hemoglobin, but their tissues extract the oxygen not using phosphates, but by using bicarbonates. And this is critical for two reasons. One is it extracts it much more slowly so that the oxygen can leach into the tissues over a long period of time. But also, the level of bicarbonate, which is a carbon-based, right, is based on the level of carbon dioxide in the tissue, and carbon dioxide is the main byproduct of metabolism. So the tissues that need more oxygen automatically get it because they're making more bicarbonate, and therefore they will extract more oxygen from the hemoglobin.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, so it's a brilliant little system. Now, what makes this fiction is that we can't get there in three genetic changes. What the research showed is that it could take as many as 20 mutations to make this happen, and that the pathway to the crocodile hemoglobin is a long and torturous one where there had to have been multiple mutations sort of happening in concert. And the
right,
reason
otherwise
why,
wouldn't we see this in like a bunch of other animals?
Exactly. That's exactly the reason why they suspected this and were looking to try to reverse engineer the evolutionary pathway to crocodilian hemoglobin, because like, this is awesome. Why doesn't everybody have it, right? Yeah, why don't, there's a lot of animals who could benefit from this from holding their breath longer, you know? And so
what
they,
that already do. They're not just crocodiles.
Yeah,
exactly. So it also makes you wonder, like, which came first, the chicken or the egg? I mean, these things must have been, obviously, the genetic changes to the hemoglobin then affected that whole bicarb system, which affected the hemoglobin, which affected the bicarb system.
Yeah. So
like,
here's
they were
the
like evolving in lockstep.
Researchers were comparing the hemoglobin of crocodiles to the hemoglobin of other extant species to try to figure out the evolutionary pathway, and it just wasn't working. So what these researchers did is they were able to reverse engineer the hemoglobin of the ancestors of crocodiles, the common ancestor and their common ancestor with birds. And so to see like what is the pathway here, and they were able to in much greater detail reverse engineer the evolutionary pathway from that common ancestor hemoglobin, the common ancestor was the group was the archosaurs, which includes crocodilians and birds. So they found that this was like really hard to evolve, and that's why it only happened once.
Neat. And then they were just so awesome at surviving.
Yeah, they became a successful group.
So how cool. Do other animals hold their breath for a long time?
They have very large lung capacity. You know, they reduce their metabolism.
Or they might have better. Also, some they might also have slightly better hemoglobin, but not this whole cool bicarb
system.
Yeah,
but this is the crocodilians are the only ones that have this system, the bicarb, which is like almost like autoregulation, you know, built in. So that doesn't mean we could never genetically engineer it, but it's just a lot harder than three quickie, you know, genetic tweaks. Yeah, right. That's funny, Bob. They call in the literature they call the crocodile hemoglobin scuba tanks. It is like the source of steady release of oxygen. You know, that's why like crocodiles drag their prey under the water.
Oh,
and
sure,
drown
because you
them.
Have no choice. Yeah,
yeah.
They do the death roll.
The prey drowns, and the crocodile's fine. They could go a long time, you know, without having to breathe. All right. All this means that an international team of scientists have found that there are millions of abandoned mines worldwide that can be converted into grid storage units with as much as 70 terawatt hours of storage, about one day of world energy use, is science. And this is pretty cool, but I was a little disappointed when I did the calculation. This wasn't in the actual study that I could find anywhere. They said, it'd be anywhere from 7 to 70. So I took the high number, the 70 terawatt hours.
As much
and
as.
And I did a calculation, and it was funny. Like I figured, just let me figure out in days, and it came out to almost exactly one day. just a coincidence. But
for the world.
Just the number for the amount of energy used by the world in a year was almost exactly.
Gosh, right? We use a lot of energy.
And yeah, we use a lot.
Based purely on what, the volume of these mines?
No. So there's they are proposing a specific grid storage solution using these mines. Unfortunately, Kara, it uses sand. So sand.
Oh, here we go. Precious resource.
Sand is the energy storage medium. But just like pumped hydro, it's pumped sand. Basically, they let the sand fall and use gravity to turn turbines and produce electricity. And then they use excess electricity to raise the sand to higher reservoirs.
So that's good because they're renewing the – they're not using up the sand.
No, they're not using up the sand.
Right,
that's right.
It doesn't destroyed or so they said repurposed.
There's, it's a global hourglass. I love that so much.
Yes, there's a couple of advantages to this. So one advantage is that there is zero energy loss. In other words, the energy does not dissipate over time because the sand doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't evaporate like water can. It doesn't slowly leak energy like a battery can, et cetera. So there's no – so you could store energy basically forever in these systems, right, which means you could shift energy from the summer to the winter, you know, or even over years using this method. So it's good long-term energy storage.
How do you get it out? What do you got to run lines to every damn cave on the world in the world?
They said that these mines are already wired, Bob. They're already wired for electricity because how else do you think they were functioning? So they already are connected to the grid. So that's an
functioning. I mean, what do you mean? They're mines. Why do you need electricity?
Well, why do you need electricity in a mine?
Yeah, but the thing is, how do you? So what? Just because there's electricity, that means we can therefore pump out a lot of energy. You wouldn't need to update the lines and make them hardier.
They might have to, but they specifically listed it as an advantage that they already have a connection to the grid. But you're right; there may need to be updates or whatever. The other advantage is that a lot of these mines are just abandoned, right? They're just sitting there. Some of them are environmentally hazardous, and so if left to their own devices, but if you convert them over to grid storage. It's actually better for the environment, right? This could be a benefit to the environment rather than posing an environmental risk or downside like even pumped hydro can. So that's good as well. Now, Jay, you ask, I know millions of mines around the world. It always blows we have no sense of scale. What they found was there's over 550,000 just in the United States.
Wow.
And that's probably an underestimate because they're not all really carefully cataloged. That's what they were able to find. So they estimate there's millions around the world.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. This isn't going to be the one grid storage solution, but this would be a good solution, again, for the long-term storage, like when you need to shift seasonally. That would be a good idea. But again, I was disappointed. I'm like, yeah, but then you get one day of electricity. But that is for the whole world. So, you know, we're not going to be running the world off of grid storage at any point.
Oh, India's out. Let's help out India for a day. You're good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, basically, you could see, like, added to the grid system – this could be significant storage, and again, it could be shifted even significant amounts of time.
Wait, how long does it take to get one day of storage?
No, if you basically fully charged all of the mines, they would run the world for a day, basically.
But don't you only need to run it for a day?
No, then you're out of energy. After one day, you're out of energy then.
Yeah, but then how much longer until they're fully charged again?
A million years.
Well, it depends on how much energy is pumped into them in order to reset them.
Yeah, that's what I'm curious about. Is it a day? Is it a day's worth? Is it a year's worth? Is it?
Yeah. So I mean, the thing is, like any grid storage, you're using it just to shift energy from production to use to balance out the grid. But this would be complementary to, I think, pumped hydro. It would be and battery. I think batteries are good for like really fast point of use kind of storage. The pumped hydro is good for massive grid storage for, you know, shifting hours to days. And this would be good for shifting months, you know, or years, just, you know, have that in the background if you need it. But I think we're probably going to need to use all of these things. But it was, you know, interesting to read about yet another method of potential grid storage that is workable and, you know, doesn't seem, this one seems to be environmentally friendly because it's using existing and abandoned infrastructure. You know, like these things are just sitting there.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, we're recycling. We're going to recycle those mines into grid storage.
How many centuries would it take to adapt a million mines?
I don't. Well, maybe. Well, yeah. I mean, how long did it? Probably less time than it took to dig them. You know, I think that digging the mine's probably the hardest part of creating these. This gravity sand grid
store. Person hours.
Yeah, Bob, it's not the same team going around to do all of that.
You'll probably have
hiring locals.
Depends how hard we crack the whips.
Yeah. Talk about a job. I mean, that's a here's a million mines. Let's put 1,000 people on it.
Well, Bob, how many people did it take to build the mines in the first place? I mean, you got to think about it that way.
It's a lot of people over centuries. I'm just saying that's a gargantuan task. It's not like let's get it ready for 2030 or 2040. Not going to happen.
I don't know. It seems more plausible to me than that.
2040? We could, if we wanted to, just hire a bunch of people.
Yeah. It's just like labor.
I think you're underestimating the amount of work that would be required.
I think you're underestimating the engineering capacity of the world.
Yeah. Like look what they just did for FIFA in like Doha. Like it's FIFA insane. And Doha. Yeah.
I don't know what you're talking
about. For the World Cup. The
World Cup in soccer.
Oh, whatever.
It's a sport, but
it has a ball.
There's a ball.
He's like, soccer. FIFA, Doha, these are not words.
Like, what?
Well, FIFA is an acronym.
I saw a mention of it on TV, but whatever.
Oh, yeah. They like literally build. I mean, it's bananas what people can build very quickly if you have enough money.
And if you have a lot of money and no ethics.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of human rights violations there. We should mention that.
Oh, my gosh. Forget right.
Jesus.
I don't even want to go there.
Nope.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
Okay, this week's quote was, provided by listener Vigo from Norway. Thank you, Vigo. He said, I thought it'd be fun to let ChatGPT generate a skeptical quote of the week this time. I hope you like it. Here was his prompt. Generate a memorable and funny quote about the importance of skepticism in today's society. Please also give a very brief analysis of your own quote and its meaning.
Nice.
And here was the answer. Here's the quote. Without skepticism, we'd believe everything we hear, like unicorns being real and pineapple on pizza being a good idea.
That's amazing.
ChatGPT.
That's really impressive, actually.
That's funny. That's funny. I happen to love pineapple on my pizza, but regardless, I'm in the spirit of the whole thing. It was very, very clever. Thank you, Vigo.
Bob, what did you tell me about ChatGPT today?
Yeah, Microsoft is they're thinking of investing $10 billion in ChatGPT.
As long as we keep it open source.
They're going to Skype it, right?
Yeah, they're
going to. Yeah, it's like what percent ownership are they going to get for that investment?
No, it's – I think if they do that, I mean, the goal isn't, I don't think, going to be like, oh, let's integrate ChatGPT into a search engine. I think they're probably thinking beyond that, and on the level of like creating it as like an AI assistant, which I think ChatGPT would be good for.
Yeah, we just don't want them to own the IP.
Right. Or they sell advertising space to Coca-Cola on every answer it generates.
Oh, next. You know that's going
to Here's your answer. Enjoy Coca-Cola.
Oh, no.
Black mirror. Please. Can't something be pure?
No, apparently not.
That would be the Simpson dystopian version of it.
Right.
I heartily endorse this event or product.
Crusty.
Okay, Evan, you already gave us a quote. All right, well, thank you.
Oh, my God. Carrot's crack.
Sorry, it's late. It's funny.
Brain fart. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, thanks, Matt. Steve.
Okay, thank you, sure.
Steve. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.